In the Literary License Podcast, Kings of Horror episodes, reading and digesting books from the masters of modern horror, and viewing the films. Your co-hosts tonight are Vicky Ray, Leandro Gazzi, Craig Johnson, David Grant, and Keith Shogger, giving you a word-by-word, scene-by-scene, and everything in between, and everything in between, and everything in between, and everything in between.
Welcome to the Literary License Podcast, and it's our books to screen, our Kings of Horror. And we are covering Peter Straub's Ghost Story in the 1981 film, A Ghost Story. And before we get started, let's find out who's with us. We got Leandro Gazzi with us. Hello, Leandro.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm good. And we got Craig Johnson. Hello, Craig.
Hello, everyone from East Finchley in London.
Hello.
Unfortunately, Vicky Ray and Joe Randazzo will not be with us due to prior commitments, but we will struggle on without them regardlessly. And besides, they're just dead air anyway. So yay, we got the live air with us today. And if you two are listening to us, this is what happens when you don't make the podcast. You become subjects of my ridicule. Anyway, passing on, I'm Keith Shago, and let's find out what each of us has been up to. Starting with you, Craig, what have you been up to since last time we spoke to you?
I basically binge watched all the Halloween movies minus the Rob Zombie movies from start to finish. But I've had this really icky cold for the last week, so I've been taking lots of Lemsip and just resting mainly. I think it's the weather change because it's like suddenly it's like freezing cold outside. So, yeah. But I've managed to sort my merchandise out. So if you check out craigsworld.org, there's merchandise things on there like water bottles and pillows and things like that if you want to check it out. Or you can Instagram me at Craig's World too, and then there's a link tree and you can see all my lovely galleries of artwork and bits and stuff I've been up to. So check it out.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, I got to admit that I kind of got that coldy, flu-y thing today as well. I'm finding myself like snoozing all day today, and last night I was got, you know, when you go in that deep sleep and it's just like, and then trying to wake up and you feel like you're in paralysis. Yeah, it's kind of weird. So yeah, so I've been having that as well. So yeah, I feel for you. I got that as well, a bit croaky as well. What about yourself, Leandro? What are you doing?
Well, carry on working. I've been working my allotment and I've been getting some onions the other day with a friend. I went to London on Friday to watch Wicked with a friend and came back today. We went to the Shark. And yeah, basically the same stuff, like going to the gym now and yeah, same stuff, reading.
You went to go see Wicked, the musical.
Yeah, the musical. Yeah, it was really cool.
We're covering that next year. Whoa.
I was telling my friend, I would like to read actually the book because I watched a movie, but I watched two movies. One with the one in black and white. I can't remember the name of the actress.
Judy Garland one.
Yeah, Judy Garland. And another one. And then when I went to watch this musical, I was a bit confused because I was asking my friend, okay, which thing happened first? And he said it's really hard to tell you because it's like all mixed up sometimes. Mm. But that was really, really cool.
Well, I mean, The Wizard of Oz was written in the 1900s. It was written by Frank Baum. There's a whole series of books. There's like 18 to 32 books of Wizard of Oz
Oh, wow.
That were written. And then basically the classic film, the Judy Garland film, is kind of a bastardized version of the book itself. It does carry on. She does go to lots more different kinds of lands and odds and stuff like this and so on and so forth. Wicked basically came out in, God, I guess it's the 1990s now. And that's basically is that Gregory, his surname escapes me, basically decided to do stuff from the Wicked Witch's point of view and about how she became who she is. And I highly recommend the book Wicked. Gregory McGuire is his name. Sorry, that's it. The book is fantastic. When I read the book, I was floored by it. But the musical is kind of a bastardized version of that book, Wicked, because Wicked is basically about, it goes a lot deeper. It's about the politics that's going on there and what's happening in Oz from a political point of view and so on and so forth. So, but I highly recommend the book. The reason why we were going to do it this year, we're going to do it next year, is because they're doing a movie version of Wicked. Mm-hmm. So I figured Christmas next year, we'll do the book Wicked and then do the movie Wicked. And then we'll probably do maybe a Wizard of Oz spinoff for our Christmas thing, because nothing spells Christmas better than the Wizard of Oz. So, and for myself, what have I been up to? Well, I've been watching, going through my, you know, watching a lot of horror films and stuff like that due to Halloween being last week. And I've seen some good stuff on Shudder and Disney Plus. I'm watching a good series on Amazon at the moment called I Know What You Did Last Summer. Was kind of a spin-off of the TV series, different characters, different locations, but that's quite fun to watch. And finished watching Creepshow, which is available on Shudder. And we had Stephen Langford, who actually writes for Creepshow, was on our show discussing that, so that was quite good. But besides that, watching bits and bobs, nothing too exciting. Working 9 to 5, so yay. Turned into a stereotype, yay. So other than that, I think it's time to go into Ghost Story. Now, Ghost Story is a horror novel by American writer Peter Straub. It was published on January 1st, 1979 by Coward, McCain, and Grugin, and adapted in 1981 as a horror film minus the fifth protagonist, Louis Benedict. It was a watershed in his career, became a national bestseller, and cemented his reputation as one of our kings of horror. So what we're going to do is going to cut the synopsis of Ghost Story, and we'll be right back.
Ghost Story by Peter Straub. The novel opens with a man named Donald Wanderley traveling with a young girl whom he has apparently kidnapped. Eventually, Donald and the girl arrive in Panama City, Florida, at which point the novel jumps back in time to the events of the previous winter. Living in a small upstate New York town of Milburn, a fictional location which is indicated to be in Broome County, east of Birmingham, are four elderly men who are members of the clique called the Chowder Society. John Jeffrey, a doctor, Louis Benedict, a retired entrepreneur, Sears James, an attorney, and Ricky Hawthorne, an attorney, and James's partner. For the past 50 years, these best friends have gathered together and told each other stories and have been great companions. However, their group once consisted of five members. 1 year earlier, Jeffrey had thrown a party at his house in honor of visiting an actress, and their fifth member, Edward Wanderley, had died in an upstairs bedroom during the festivities. There was a look of absolute horror on his face, as if he had been frightened to death. Ever since that night, the friends have been plagued with horrible nightmares, and have taken to telling each other ghost stories. At one of their meetings, Sear tells them a ghost story about when he was a young man. Before deciding to attend law school, James is taking a teaching position in a rural community. He developed a fascination with one of his students, a slow, mentally disturbed young boy named Fenny Bate. Fenny and his sister were ostracized by the community, and upon making some inquiries, he finds out why. The two children once had an older brother named Gregory, and it was generally believed that Gregory sexually molested his younger brother. The mother of the siblings was dead, their father had abandoned the family, and Gregory was his younger sibling's guardian. One day, while repairing a roof, Gregory fell off the ladder and was killed. and someone thought they saw the two young bait children running away from the scene. Sears tells his friends that in time he began to see a threatening young man hanging around the school, and he eventually came to believe it is to be the spirit of Gregory Bait. Sears attempted to save Fenny from the clutches of his dead brother, but to no avail. Fenny died, and Sears left the small community when he had finished the school year. The next morning after telling his story, Sears and Ricky are called out to the farm of one of their clients, who has found some mutilated livestock in his field. Later in the car, Sears reveals to Ricky that the previous night's story was not fictitious, but had actually happened to him in his youth. Sears admits that he is scared, and as are all the members of the Childhood Society. They decide to write to Edward's nephew, Donald Wanderley, as Donald had written an occult novel, and they think that his research abilities might be employed on their behalf. Before Donald arrives, however, Jeffrey dies in an apparent suicide by jumping off a bridge. Donald arrives just as the funeral is coming to a close. The three remaining members of society tell him that they want to investigate any possible avenues that he might deem appropriate. Several years previously, Donald's brother David had died under mysterious circumstances, and it led him to write his horror novel. Donald tells them the story of what he thinks actually happened. He had landed a teaching position at Berkeley on the strength of a good reception for his first novel, and began seeing a beautiful graduate student named Alma Mobley. At first, he was inseparable from her, and there was a talk of marriage. But over time, he began to notice strange things about her, and felt there was something unnatural about Alma. For example, she had a sinister drug-dealing acquaintance named Greg Benton, who was the guardian of a mentally disabled younger brother. Even more sinister acquaintances who belonged to a cult associated with the Manson family and claimed to be in regular contact with the spirit of the dead man named Tasker Martin, who approved the relationship. Donald stopped seeing her as much. His work suffered, and one day Alma simply vanished. Upon investigating, he discovered that a great many things that Alma had told him about her past were fabrications. For example, she claimed to be the daughter of a wealthy New Orleans artist named Robert Mobley, who had two sons but no daughter. In fact, Robert Mobley had once had a bizarre experience somewhat similar to Donald's, in which his son Shelby had committed suicide following an affair with a mysterious younger girl named Amy Mockton, under the guardianship of a woman named Florence DePacer, who employed a sinister man named Greg Gregorio as her chauffeur. A few months later, David called him and told him that he and Amy were engaged and that he wanted things to be right between Donald and his fiancée. Donald tried to warn David about Alma, but to no avail, and soon afterwards, David was dead. Not long after this, Louis Benedict is murdered in the forest, and Sears and Ricky decide that it is time to tell Donald the most terrible story that the Childish Society knows, and it is too, is a true story. 50 years previously, a young woman named Ava Galley had moved to the town. She was in her early 20s, and all five of the young men fell head over heels for her, although it was purely platonic love. One night in 1929, not long after Black Tuesday, Ava came to see them, but she was not acting like herself. She made sexual advances and belittled them. There was a struggle, and Ava fell and hit her head. Believing her to be dead, they conspired to hide the body by putting it in a car and driving it into a dead pond. But at that last moment, Ava's body disappeared from the inside of the car, and there was a lynx looking at them from the other bank. Donald begins his research and quickly comes to the conclusion that what they are dealing with is a manito, or some other kind of shape-shifting creature. He also believes that Alma Mobley is actually Ava Galley, and is also Amy Mockton, and a mysterious young actress who was the guest of honor at the party in which his uncle died. He finds some of his uncle's tape recordings and listens to parts not even his uncle had heard yet, where she speaks directly to him and the surviving Childress Society, saying she belongs to an ancient race of beings and that she herself is old enough to remember the first humans in the country. Donald, Ricky, and Sears are joined in their struggle by Peter Barnes, a young man whose mother was killed by these creature servants, previously normal human beings who have been granted new life and powers. Sears is ambushed and killed in his car, and the survivors now realize that the reanimated Gregory and Fenny are helping Ava in her endeavors, and that Gregory is identical to Greg Benton, the drug dealer Donald had encountered in Berkeley, and Fenny was Greg Benton's disabled brother, and Gregory and Robert Mobley, New Orleans acquaintances, Gregorio, were also one and the same. Gregory tells him that Florence DePazer helped resurrect him, and that Ava is also subservient to the DePazer woman. Gregory and Fenny attack Peter, Donald, and Ricky in a movie theater, but they are both killed in the ensuing struggle, leaving Donald to realize that though they have otherworldly powers, the creatures are not truly immortal. The survivors track Ava down and defeat her, but she escapes in a new shape. Exhausted, Ricky leaves Milburn for an extended vacation with his wife, and Peter prepares for college. Donald keeps watch to see what form Ava will next appear in, and believes it to be the little girl in the opening part of the book. While in Florida, Ava emerges from the form of the little girl and attempts to twist Donald's mind. He is able to resist and kills her after she tries to take the form of a wasp to escape. Donald then prepares to go to San Francisco to hunt down the DePazer woman. And that is the synopsis for Ghost Story by Peter Straub.
Hello, welcome back to Literature License Podcast, and we're discussing Ghost Story by Peter Straub, which was published in 1979. And starting with you, Craig, how did you find the book Ghost Story?
This book was really, really detailed. It's a big book as well. I mean, it took me a good month to complete this one, and normally I'm quite fast with books. But the detail was just really, really lovely. For example, I'll give you an excerpt. When sleep finally came to Ricky Hawthorne, it was as if he were not merely dreaming, but had in fact been lifted bodily and still awake into another room in another building. He was lying in bed in a strange room, waiting for something to happen. The room seemed deserted, part of an abandoned house. Its walls and floor were bare planks, and the window was only an empty frame. Sunlight leaked in through a dozen cracks. Dust particles swirled in these stark rays of light. He did not know how he knew it, but he knew that something was going to happen and that he was afraid of it. He was unable to leave the bed, but even in his muscles were working, he knew with the same knowledge that he would not be able to escape whatever was coming. The room was on an upper floor of the building. Through the window, he only saw grey clouds and a pale blue sky. But whatever was coming was going to come from inside, not out there. I love how Peter Straub has just, even in like minuscule everyday stuff, he's really, really like detailed. And I really picked up on that. I really love that book about the book. And obviously I love the fact that the months tied in with the season that we're in as well. So it kind of fitted like a jigsaw, and it made me feel quite cozy, and you know, but I think the dark side of the book, I think you know, I was confused a little bit. I wasn't sure. At one point I thought, is the lady a ghost, or is she like an incubus or a succubus? And at one point in the book, they describe her as a shapeshifter, which was like, when I found that, I thought, oh my days, that's like something out of The Thing, you know? So it had like quite dark undertones. But yeah, really, really beautifully, really beautifully written. And yeah.
I mean, what I found about Ghost Story is quite interesting is that basically you're expecting it to be about a ghost, and it's not really about a ghost as well. It's about a manitobe. Basically, a manitobe is a fictional character that you would find, and it's actually a Native American, and basically it's a shapeshifter that basically causes havoc and gets revenge based on the human race. And basically, and in order for it to sustain and have its willing done is that basically if it decides that if it wants you to work for it, it will offer you internal life, but internal life would only be captured to you that after through your death, and then basically that you will have internal life that you can resurface as yourself as a ghost or a spirit world per se, giving a 3D human context to yourself, but you're there to do their bidding sort of thing. So you don't have any free will, though you can live through the ages. And what I quite like about Ghost Story is that you're never quite sure of anything. basically, you start out in the beginning, basically, you start out with the kidnapping this girl, which I have to say that is quite racy considering that, you know, he has to tie the girl to himself before he sleeps and stuff like this, and then in a hotel room and sort of thing. And then what we do is then we get pushed forward to the town of Milburn. Now, the thing about Milburn is what's quite interesting is that basically it's a fictionalized town, but it's actually not, but it's actually based in a town that's not too far from where I grew up. And that's where, it's actually where my sister, it's actually where my sister lives now in the town that they're based on. So for me, it kind of like, oh, okay, this is quite cool. But then we find out that basically the ghost stories that the Chowder Society are giving, are saying, are that they're not ghost stories. They're actually true. You know, we hear about Finn and how Finn's been having sex with his brother, and that basically the brother and sister kill him. And then he tries to save him when he's, you know, being a school teacher. And then we find out that later that they are part of this Anne Mobley and, you know, Alma characters. They're part of her world sort of thing. And they made deals with her. And it's, you know, it's like this great big murder mystery that has this, you know, horrific context to it in the supernatural. But then as the story goes on, he actually realizes, you know, it's not just the Chowder Society that, you know, that Alma's after. She's after, it's actually the whole town. Because by the end of it, I mean, she's pretty much sweeping through and killing almost everybody in this town to a certain extent and haunting everyone. And, you know, and then you find out the real reason being is that back in the, you know, turn of the century, not about the 1910s, 1920s, you find out that basically that she was there. In town, she was dating the one guy that everyone wanted, the stud, who is the brother of these two sisters. He dies mysteriously, that basically he bleeds to death by having his limbs cut off. And the town pretty much shun her, except for the Chowder Society, who were boys, because they used to go visit her and stuff like that. There's nothing sexual with the way that they're visiting her. They're like friends and they're enthralled by her. And then basically what you end up having is that when this happens, they kind of shy away from her as well. And then she, you know, then an accident happens and they thought that she died, and they do, you know, and then basically they throw her, you know, they put her in the pond and stuff like this, thinking she died. And she basically shapeshifts into a fox who looks at them and runs away, but they didn't realize it was her at the time. And they put all the pieces together. And that's what I find what's quite interesting about Ghost Story is like this, it is a thick book, but it's basically, it's all these little puzzles they're giving you, all these little pieces, and all of a sudden it's like, and then they start joining them up. And then as the more and more they join them up, the mystery gets solved. And it's not straightforward. It's not a straightforward book, which is quite, what I found quite interesting. It means that Peter Straub must have a very intricate mind about how he writes his stuff, because it's not a straightforward tale sort of thing.
There's like a three tales in one, almost.
And how did you find, you being from UK, being English, you used to live near there, mm-hmm. When he described the place, accurate or so?
Very accurate. I mean, the thing is like, if you look at the town that I grew up on, basically the town I grew up is very colonial. It stayed very colonial. Everything in where I grew up, there hasn't been a house that's been built that's been passed 1872. The newest house is built. And when you get to small towns in upstate New York and stuff like that, they're all like this. They're all like, you know, you have cities are not that, you know, they're not close. So you do have like a town center, and you do have town politics, and every, you know, you have your own police department. We had one in Sackett's Harbor. And they kind of know everyone, and then you have your own lawyers and your own doctors and stuff like this, and they're all part of your community. So yeah, that all fit sort of thing. And the winters was like that sort of thing. I mean, winter comes earlier in this book than in normal, but basically, you know, the reason why I don't go home at Christmas time is because I might not be able to get out for another 2 months if I do go home. Mm-hmm. For me to get home, for instance, I have to fly to Toronto. I have to take a train to Kingston, and then I have to take a ferry across the lake, and then drive another 3 to 4 hours. It's in the middle of nowhere. So I think it's very pretty, but it's just in the middle of nowhere. And you get cut off in the wintertime. We had the blizzard of 77 that we got off for 6 weeks from anywhere. After I left, they had an ice storm. And up there was without electricity for 7 to 8 weeks. So basically, you know, sometimes you have to live by your wood stove and you can't get out of your house. You can't go to a store. You can't do anything. And you're kind of, you just stay inside and you're kind of trapped. You know, and you learn to get on with your family without killing each other. I mean, it's good for that. And we had the extra thing that I grew up on a farm. So that way when you did get snowed in, I mean, those cows still need to be milked. So you still had to struggle through. And basically, you know, I remember, you know, having snow drifts. You know, I grew up in a 3-story house and we had to actually slide down from the attic window one time because we couldn't get out the doors and stuff because all the snow was all piled up against the house or anything. So that was very well executed and stuff like this. And the whole thing about like when you're going, you know, when you do out, you know, and going into a snowdrift and you like, you know, you have to like step into it and all of a sudden it's like you find yourself up to your waist and you can find yourself get buried sometimes in that sort of stuff. So in the cold, no matter how many scarves you have wrapped around or hats, that you're just freezing because your nose feels like it's about to freeze off and sort of thing. So he's very, very, very accurate about that.
Yeah, I really enjoyed how he was describing the things. For example, when he was with the little girl in the car, like the details he was giving about the radio stations and how they were really something really simple but really cool. You know, he was saying like the man could know where more or less where he was going because the type of advertisement that were like passing on the radio. And I really enjoy it because we have read other books that he was giving you descriptions of places, like for example Moby Dick, and it was tedious. It was explaining you for me too much, but this one it was explaining you with like little things, but it was I could make the mental picture of the situation like that, and I like that.
Yeah, I found with Peter Straub's it's quite good because it's not like with his narrative passages, they are kind of mixed with dialogue and information, but it's okay. It kind of bleeds everything together, so therefore it's not like endless, you know.
Yeah
I mean, as you know, especially like last year when we were doing classic novels, where you get like, you know, let's take Moby Dick, where you got 250 pages worth of whaling about whaling and how to whale and so on and so forth, and you're just like, oh my god, get on with it. Where he kind of does the same thing, but he does it so he'll give you little bits of information, but meanwhile, the action's still going. The action doesn't stop when he's giving you the information, which I quite like. I like that sort of thing because you don't find yourself getting bored. You don't find yourself glassy-eyed, or you don't find yourself like start scanning, scanning the paragraph because like, oh, get on with it.
I imagine that also happens if you're reading a novel that like is a classic. I imagine that for us, we did well. To imagine that situation, you will need more details. Right, and the more closer we come to our time, I can explain you something in a way that you will be making that picture really easily if I'm describing it properly.
Well, I also think is that you know, this book was in 1979 as well, and we're not as globalized as we are today, but at the same time, I think that, you know, back in like classic novels and stuff like this, people didn't really have a global sense of things that were outside their world. So
they didn't know how to get a lot of detail. Yeah.
To make them understand. Where now, you know, especially like when you read novels today, you don't have to give as much detail today because, you know, we're even more global than we are at this time. So yeah, I do. To understand, and I also think it's a modern way of writing as well, sort of thing that you just learn to, you know, you can carry. I mean, you can carry your story forward by giving details and stuff like this, but you can breadcrumb that through your story, sort of thing. So, you know, instead of like giving it all at once, feed a little bit each time. You know, feed a little bit as you're going through. Now there is a book that we will be doing it, you know, in this season, and American Psycho, you're going to find a lot of scripted text, which is, I found, it'll be interesting to see when we get to that, because I found that book a little bit hard going, and that's, you know, that's from the 80s sort of thing. But yeah, I think that Peter Straub, I mean, I can, this book actually did make me want to read more of his stuff. And apparently some of his other books, you know, like Ricky Hawthorne is mentioned in Floating Dragon. The Town of Milburn is mentioned briefly in Coco, another book he did in 1988. So I'd be quite interesting. The only Peter Straub I read is stuff that he's written with Stephen King. He wrote Talisman with Stephen King. It's the one that they co-authored together, and then the sequel to that called Black House. And so I read both of those, and I quite liked those. But I didn't know too much about Peter Straub. The Ghost Story is one of those books I've always wanted to read, but I never actually got around to reading it till now. So I'm glad I got a chance to read it. So what did you think about basically having like the prologue? And then what we do is at the end of the book, we kind of get the whole story and everything finished. It had a nice little, it finished everything off quite nicely. Did you like the way that happened, Craig?
Yeah, I liked it. It was nice to, it tied it up. And I love, it really tied it up with the ending, which made me question even more things, but, I liked how with the descriptions of Binghamton, and they said that it was like a lifeline to the town sort of thing. It made me feel like it was like a living and breathing thing. I just want to read this one as well, which was the Eva Galley and the Manitou. And it says, it was surely October on this very night of last year that I journeyed down here, that I brought a dread burden down here, which was a Edgar Allan Poe quote. And then he describes the weather, the season so well. He says, 2 days of a shift in the weather, the snow ceased and the sun returned. It was like 2 days of a wayward Indian summer. The temperature rose above freezing for the first time in a month and a half. The town square turned into a soupy marsh. Even the pigeons avoided. And as the snows melted, the river grayer and faster than on the day John Jeffrey stepped off the bridge, came nearly up to its banks. And I love the description of the Chowder Society as well, how they were... It made me think, like, is there other fraternity houses... what do you call them? Eligible bachelors societies. Like, how many of these is going on in different towns? And they must have their own quirks and their own, eccentricities, you know? Mm. And I think it really came across in the book really well.
There's some quite interesting things here that, you know, we have, you know, Donald and David sort of thing, David, you know, but it's the Eva Galley. So basically Eva Galley is basically, we find out that she's been Elma Mobley. She's been Eva Galley. She's Amy Mockton and a mysterious young actress who actually is a guest of honor at a party at which Donald's uncle dies. So we find out that this person keeps appearing over and over as different things. But we also realize that there is the DePazer woman that appears. And for some reason she's a key to everything, but we're not quite sure what that key is, because the book basically ends with, you know, Donald's going to hunt for her in San Francisco. And that's the way the book ends, to find out what the linchpin is. But what I also liked is that some of the people that, you know, are hanging around Elma Mobley, especially as a graduate school, she's hanging out with people who were with the Manson family. And she's hanging out with people that were, you know, with, you know, Tasker Martin. And then, you know, but then you find out later that these people basically who are part of these things are part of her ghostly you know, Fenton and part of these ghostly people that she's basically giving everlasting life, but they come in different disguises and they're changing their names. And, but yeah, it's kind of a story that it's really interesting. And I really like, but it's kind of a story that once you finish it, to try to wrap your head around sometimes is, yeah, there is a bit of confusion to it, but I don't know if that's confusion to that. You don't, it's not a confusion about understanding it. It's a confusion about how this could all happen. You know, if there is something out there that changes its name, but doesn't really. And she, I think she even changes her face a little bit, doesn't she? Every time that she appears, she's slightly different from before. But her personality is not that different. And she just tends to disappear. Creates havoc, someone dies, she disappears, and then reappears as somebody else. But the thing is, you never really know the reasoning behind that, really. You know, she just sit there, I think she's just there to create hell for these characters. You know, she basically gets in her head that she basically, you know, and the thing is, all we know is about what's going on in Milburn sort of thing. But obviously, she's doing this wherever she goes. So obviously, there might be like, plenty of other towns and stuff like this that she's actually being doing this with, you know, and it's not just people who are against her or something like that. She kills people that she doesn't even, she has no connection with, that basically she just feels like, you know, everything's her thing. People are playthings.
Well, but I found that, you know, now that you said this, really interesting. I've been thinking in a lot of movies and stories that I have heard, it's like sometimes, like some, well, you know, that pattern is like a ghost is someone that died and haven't finished things, right? And now, even when I was reading about this story or other stories, it's like it's always sometimes happens that, for example, that the ghost was from the person was from our time and has an unsolved problem. Then all of us died because life happened. And then probably until the ghost would carry on going around pestering people until one person take the job of and solve that problem, and then it would be kind of released. So I think I could say maybe it's related to that it doesn't matter who in the process will be suffering, because that until the problem has not been solved, the things carry on and stay there. I know what you mean. I understand. It's like, yeah. So in some stories, you say, okay.
Yeah.
1, 2, and 3 are the characters, and these are the ones who the bad things will be happening.
Mm.
But I think that could be not the case.
I mean, I found it. The only thing I found in the story that I tried to wrap my head around is the David and Donald, the brothers. So basically, she's with Donald. They meet at school. And the thing about her character, the Manitoba, is that it's kind of like a mold. She has a way of like, you know, like slowly, everything she touches slowly starts decaying. And, you know, with him, basically, they're like, he's doing really well. He met this girl, and then he meets her. And then basically his career starts to, you know, suffer and everything like that. And then he goes to the brother's cottage and they're staying there. And that's when he realizes that there's something a bit off with her. And then so they break up, and then she goes running off to David. And then so David and David's like going, oh, we're going to get married. And he's like, you know, don't trust her or whatever. And then of course he dies, commits suicide for whatever reasons. And she just disappears. And that, which of course, you know, and then he writes a book, which actually causes, because of he wrote this book, and he's not the son of one of the Chowder. In fact, he's the nephew of someone in the Chowder, which is, you know, when we get to the movie, we'll be discussing the differences here. But you kind of wonder, it's like, what, you know, you kind of wonder why she went after him, because they're not direct ascendants, they're nephews, sort of thing. And, you know, and to be honest, if she didn't go after them and basically you know, Donald will never got involved in this, and she could have basically had her way with whatever going on, because it's Donald that comes back to town that puts all the pieces together and basically is able to figure out what exactly she is and what's going on here, and he's the one that puts everything together. But if she never screwed around with him at the beginning, she just had carte blanche to do whatever she wanted in this town. Because to be honest, the Chowder Society didn't really know much, and they were having difficulty putting the pieces together. They had an idea, but they couldn't get the pieces together. And it's Donald that was able to put everything together, which is quite interesting. But I mean, another thing that I found very interesting is with the young boy that basically, gets kind of caught up with that, with basically his mom's having an affair with one of the Chowder Societies. She ends up at his house. Basically casing it, finds his mom, goes in after, because he realizes that there's something amiss here, and then basically they choke her and kill his mom, sort of thing, which gets him involved in the situation. And I thought that was quite interesting to throw this young guy who has nothing to do with him really, and let's face it, you got an 18-year-old being thrown in the world with a bunch of 70-year-olds, which I thought was quite an interesting premise. And I quite like that sort of thing. And then basically, his girlfriend gets killed. She gets kind of wrapped up in it as well. She's ended up there. The sheriff starts going mad. And that's what I quite like about the book as well, that it wasn't just your Chowder Society or the people that she had direct access to, but it was kind of affecting everybody. And then you got like these neighbors and everything like that, and it's affecting them, and there's violence is growing and people are killing each other in their own homes. And that's what I quite liked about Ghost Story, that it wasn't just a story about these key characters. It's basically a whole story about the town itself and how the whole town is decaying and falling apart. And that's what I quite liked about Ghost Story.
It was like the town was just going into chaos, and it was like a virus type entity that was like involving in itself into different people's lives, sort of thing, and age to hold no bounds as well. Mm-hmm. It's quite interesting.
I mean, she's very, she's very vindictive. I mean, but you know what? I found another thing that was quite interesting about Peter Straub's story as well, that that basically when her intended to be or her fiance basically gets killed, and the whole town basically turn their back, and that basically that no one, it's like for the funeral or anything like that, and no one actually cared about her. They all turned their back on her. That, let's face it, something happens and you're engaged to get married to someone and that person dies. Normally you have like a team and everyone gathers around you, but no one gathered around her. And that seems to be basically what started this whole thing going, sort of thing, is that the whole town basically ignored her or shooed her. She was something to, she was the biggest, she was a sin not to acknowledge, that basically if, they're like holding her responsible, that basically if she wasn't engaged to him, then he might have lived. Though we do find out later that she might have something to do with his murder, but the town doesn't that at times, sort of thing. So, and it seems like that basically, as we said before, the movie is kind of a difference. It's its own thing, which we'll get to. But it sounds like basically that, she's after the whole town, basically. She's there to just get her revenge and do it whatever way she wants to. And there's no getting out, and then we find out later in the book is that basically there's, she even comes back, is that once everything's done and you think everything's settled, then she decides to try it. She'll shapeshift as a little girl, which we find out later that little girl is her. And then basically she shapeshifts into a fly or a mosquito? A wasp. She turns into a wasp and he kills the wasp, which is the end of her. So basically, he gets rid of the girl, and then of course she shapeshifts into a wasp trying to get away. But luckily Donald knows enough to get rid of her, and that's how he gets rid of her. But every time they try to get rid of this character, she just shapeshifts into something else. So it was quite interesting the way that they were able to end you know, Alma. I mean, I guess we'll stick to Alma. Let's call her Alma throughout everything because there's so many different, she has so many character names that, you know, that's the way to get, you know, that's the way they actually have to get rid of her. They have to, you know, you have to, you kill her or whatever happens, and then you got to make sure that she hasn't shapeshifted into anything else, sort of thing. Odd, but different. So, on a how many Alma movies would you score this out of five? Starting with you, Craig.
Oh, definitely. I'd, for the detail, I'll give it 5 out of 5.
What about yourself, Leandro?
Same.
And myself, I'm going to give it a solid 5 out of 5. I think. I don't know if I won't read this book anytime soon again, but you know, I can find myself picking this up and reading it again at some point because I really, really did enjoy it. I thought,
yeah, well, what I really like is, like, for example, I know now because I have read several books from Stephen King, and I like the way he describes things and how he explains things, right, in the story. And with this book, I found it that also I like it the way, maybe it's you could find maybe a similarity, not exactly the same, but I like the way, and I've been really enjoying all these books we have been reading because the last ones, because it's like a kind of like travel around USA. I don't know, I enjoy that when, you know, when the description is good and then you can imagine the place and maybe, I don't know, it happened, I haven't done it this time, but in other time that sometimes if they name a place, I go try to go to Google Earth to see how it is.
I like the complexity of the book, but I like the fact that it was complex, but it wasn't overcomplicated. It was easy to follow because sometimes, you know, when you're reading something and then it's just there's at one point you say, "What the hell is going on?" You have to then read back. But, It was quite easy to follow, but really, really complex, and it was really well detailed, well written.
I mean, I also say it does stick in your head after you read. Now, I've read, since finishing this book, I've now read 4 books. I'm in the middle of a 4th book after finishing this book because I've, you know, this took me a while to read, but I have book reviews that need to be done, so I put those off and I read this, and then I read the other 4 books, and I have to sit there and say that out of the 4 books I read, this book still stuck in my head further than the ones I've been doing reviews on. So yeah, my hat's off to Ghost Story. This brings us to Ghost Story, the 1981 American supernatural horror film directed by John Irvin and starring Fred Astaire, Mervyn Douglas, Douglas Fairbanks Jr., John Houseman, Craig Wasson, and Alice Creed, based on the 1979 novel. It follows a group of elderly businessmen in New England who gather to recount their involvement in a woman's death decades prior when one of them suspects her ghost has been haunting them. It was the last film to feature Fred Astaire, Douglas Fairbanks Jr., and Melvin Douglas, who died 4 months before the film was released, and the first film to feature Michael O'Neill. The film was shot in Woodstock, Vermont, Saratoga Springs, New York, and Stetson University in DeLon, Florida. It was released in the United States on December 18th, 1981. We're going to cut to the trailer, but we're also going to cut to the synopsis, which we had recorded, because the movie story is a bit different from the book story, so we'll be right back.
I will take you places where you have never been.
Just a start.
I will show you things that you have never seen.
Beginning.
And I will see the life run out of you.
Long ago, on a cold, dark night, In this peaceful New England village, something happened. Something too terrifying to remember. Something too frightening to forget. Something that has remained a secret until now.
Is anyone else seeing these? Am I the only one having nightmares?
Universal Pictures presents Fred Astaire, Melvin Douglas, Douglas Fairbanks Jr., John Houseman, Ghost Story, from the terrifying best-selling novel by Peter Straub.
Who is this?
He's found a picture of her. That's not possible.
The girl, the men, the evil, silence.
Dad, I'm telling you, something happened. I'm telling you something. I think he may have been murdered.
The house, the fear, the nightmare, the vengeance, the terror, the truth.
Not now, Rick.
Yes, now. Something's happening. Something terrible. I fear that more of us are going to die.
No, we must talk about it.
She is not the person you think she is.
Who are you?
Oh, no, please, let's not stop.
She's worried you have the wrong idea about her.
Everything about her is wrong.
No, please. Please, let me talk about her.
Get away from her, Dave.
What are you?
She's dangerous.
Listen to me, please.
Soon they will learn that they have never been forgiven. Ghost Story. The time has come to tell the tale.
Ghost Story, the film synopsis. In a small New England town during the frigid winter season of 1979, four elderly friends, businessman Ricky Hawthorne, lawyer Sears James and Dr. John Jaffrey, and Mayor Edward Charles Wanderley, form the Chowder Society, an informal men's club who get together each week to share tales of horror. Edward's son David, living in New York City, falls from his apartment window after seeing a girl he's been sleeping with suddenly turn into a living corpse. His other son, Don, comes home at Edward's request. Sometime after David's funeral, Edward sees him walking through town during a snowstorm and follows him to a bridge where he disappears. Calling out to his dead son, Edward suddenly sees a female apparition and he falls to his death from the bridge. Meanwhile, two escaped patients from a mental asylum, Gregory and Fanny Bate, have taken up residence in the old Ava Galley house, now in ruins. Doubting his father committed suicide, Don approaches the remaining three friends and tells them a ghost story to gain membership into the Chowder Society. In a flashback, Don tells the story of how he, a college professor in Florida, began a torrid affair with a mysterious secretary named Alma, soon becoming engaged. Alma insisted she wanted to marry Don in his hometown of Milburn, but he was reluctant, as he considered the town boring. Don soon began to suspect that something was wrong with Alma, a gut feeling that was vindicated one night when he touched her and realized she was as cold as a corpse. Don eventually broke things off with a furious Alma, who disappeared from his life. He fell into a deep depression, costing him both his reputation and his job. A month later, Don called David in New York and learned to his horror that he has become engaged to Alma. Don desperately tried to warn David about her, but his brother scoffed at the warning. The elderly friends reacted to Don's story. Sears remains very skeptical. Don then shows the three elders an old photograph he's found among his father's possessions. In it, there is a striking young woman who is a dead ringer for Alma. Jeffrey, realizing what has happened, pleads with his friends to tell the truth, but is rebuffed. The next day, Jeffrey has a nightmare about Alma and dies of a heart attack. Sears and Ricky finally explained to Don that, in the spring of 1929, the four friends became smitten with a young, flirtatious girl named Ava Galley. Edward first took her to bed, but he was impotent with her. Outside her house, the other three friends serenaded Ava in hopes of catching a glimpse of her, when a shirtless Edward came to the window instead, giving the impression that he slept with her. ever left with his friends. The four became very drunk, discussing Ava's prowess in the bedroom. They returned to the house, where all but Sears danced with her. When it was proposed that they leave, Sears suggestively insisted on getting his dance, to which Ava pointedly responded that she intended to dance with all of them. Ava confronted Edward about what he had told his friends, then began to tell them the truth when young Edward leapt to silence her, knocking her down and accidentally smashing her head into the stone fireplace. Horrified, the young man believed the unresponsive Ava to be dead. They considered calling the police, but realized it would only mean ruining their lives. Instead, they load Ava's body into a car and pushed her into a nearby lake. As the car descended, Ava stirred inside, looking out at them from the back window, screaming and hammering at the glass as the car sank. Back in the present, Ava and Sears revealed that the Chowder Society never talked about it again, not even with each other. Due to Ava's reputation, the townsfolk were relieved when she'd gone missing and assumed that she simply skipped town. However, they admitted that her death has haunted them all these years. Whereas Sears is dubious, but Ricky and Don believe that Alma and Ava are the same woman and that her ghost has returned to seek revenge. Don suggests they go to Ava's old house to confront the past and her ghost once and for all. They go there, but Don falls on the rotting stairs and breaks his legs. Sears leaves in his car to seek help, leaving Don and Ricky behind. While driving through the snowstorm, Sears comes upon Ava's apparition. He slams on the brakes and swerves to the side of the road. He survives but is attacked and killed by Fenny Bake, one of Ava's accomplices. Ricky realizes something happened to Sears and leaves to get help. He's picked up by Gregory Bate, who tells him of Ava's plans for them both, but Ricky stabs him and escapes, telling the authorities to pull Ava's car up from the lake to reveal her body inside. This is intercut with Don, who confronts the rotting specter of Alma/Ava. Ricky and the authorities drag out the ancient car and wrench open the rusted, corroded door. The rotting corpse of Ava lunges into view and falls harmlessly to the ground. Now that the truth about Ava is known, Don is spared from her vengeance and the town is restored to peace. And that is the film synopsis of Ghost Story.
Hello, welcome back to Literature License Podcast. We're discussing Ghost Story, the 1981 film directed by John Irwin. So, Leandro, what are your thoughts of Ghost Story, the 1981 film?
Well, it's the first time I watch a movie with Fred Astaire. I have seen some little videos of him dancing, but I never saw him acting. I really enjoyed the movie. For me, it's really funny to, when I watch these type of movies, watch the visual effects. And for example, when the man was falling from the that kind of New York, I don't know, skyscraper, was really fun because he realized that the images like overlapped. and the same, you know, when for example, when they were showing you, there was like a ghost, but at the same time, a person. That I found it really, really clever. No, I really enjoyed the movie. I think it's like really, well, of course, these days, well, at least to me, I watch this movie and I don't feel like the fear of being scary. And I think it's because these days, even the reality is harder than the movies sometimes, you know, it's like, but no, I really enjoyed the twist that they made. And yeah. No, it was really, really, really clever. I don't know. I can't remember the name of the actress.
Alice Krieg.
But I think that she was, I don't know who also who chose her, but it's amazing because this lady has like, I don't know, for me, right? Like a crazy face. Like someone, you know, when you were... also, well, imagine that she's a really good actress because you can see that. But it's like she was looking to the character she was talking to, and you see that it's like there's something that you can understand. You know, the way she looks is like, yeah. No, it was. I really, really, really enjoyed watching this movie. You know, sometimes you watch these movies and oh, it's another half an hour. But no, this one wasn't the case. I really enjoyed it. Also, when appeared the plowman with the machine, you know, that and that scene for me was really, really cool. Actually, he appeared twice. And I really, really enjoyed it. I would recommend it.
And about yourself, Craig, what are your thoughts of the film?
I like the movie. It was dated, don't get me wrong, but it was 1981, so I give it some allowances. But I like the chowder scenes. There's a lot of smoking, which is unusual because you don't see that normally anymore because smoking's so taboo sort of thing nowadays. So that was interesting. But it was quite... I could get into the scene and, you know, I could imagine like it probably like their reading rooms probably smelt like cedar wood and things like that, and I got the gist of that, and it was quite nice. I liked the scenes where there was the ghost, where she would just pop up sort of thing, but it wasn't just a ghost, it was almost like a creep show, like zombified skeletal thing, you know. That was quite funny, but quite cool. I thought, god, you know, it's sort of almost like two movies, like, because it was you've got the whole suspenseful ghost story, but then you've got like, they remind you, shit, you know, it's an 80s movie and it's horror. So then they'll throw that in. It had the sort of vibe of the Murder on the Orient Express. That's how I would describe the movie, where everyone's involved in the end. And, you know, and I kind of felt sorry for, I sort of felt sorry for, the ghost in the end, because, you know, at the end of the day, you know, they all took a part in killing her because of bravado, and then when you see her in the carriage and she's actually alive, and then not only if they thought they'd murdered her but they hadn't, and then she's going to drown and then I thought, yeah, come on, come back with a vengeance and get these bastards, you know. But it was all right. It was a good movie to watch. I preferred the book, though, I've got to say. But I think because the book was more detailed, I think they probably didn't have enough time to include as much detail, and with the budget that was in the book. And maybe that's why there must have been directorial differences or something, where that it just got chopped and changed.
I found with the film, which is kind of bizarre, is that... I think they had a good script sort of thing. And then, you know, of course she's not a Manitou, she's a shapeshifter now. I mean, she's a ghost now sort of thing. And so basically they had to, you know, chop and change story to fit that narrative. The thing is that the guy, you know, her death scene, you know, like in the book, for instance, her death scene basically is, you know, she lures him back to the house, and basically it's, you know, they accidentally push her sort of thing. But she's the antagonist behind it. The movie, the guys are the antagonist behind her death. And so it kind of shit the whole change from the book sort of thing, because basically it's like, you know, one guy couldn't get it up, and then he brings all his friends drunk to her house expecting, you know, and then they're all expecting to get some because she gave it out to one person. And then it becomes kind of this kind of a rape sexual thing, you know, which, you know, and then as you were saying, is that, you know, and then her, you know, he accidentally pushes her, she hits her head against something, basically.
It's almost... Keith, it's almost like saying back then, like, these things were accepted, and, you know, if this woman, you know, if you ever get in a situation where there's like a frat house versus a woman and something happens, then, you know, it's okay, you know, just dispose of her in the pond, you know. But
thing is like, you know, because of the story, I mean, the movie, I think the movie works on its own merit sort of thing, but, you know, the thing is, if she is getting revenge on these people and stuff like this, they kind of deserved it. You know, yeah. And the funny thing about it, like in the book, they don't deserve it. What's going on in the book is totally different. But in the movie, they kind of deserve what's happening to them, really. They're guilty of killing her, living prosperous lives, getting on with their lives, and then basically just having her at the bottom of the pond, or the, it's not even a lake, just at the bottom of a pond sort of thing.
Yeah, it's really funny when the car was drowning, and then one of them goes up to the knees or something like that, and he was standing there.
And there's a tell, is like they didn't, I don't know if they felt guilty about it, because at the end of the day, because normally what you see is like if something happens, you get a group of friends, and let's say someone dies, you know, due to careless or whatever. And then what we normally would find is that those friends are all fractured. They don't stay together. You know what I mean? They kind of like, you know, we won't mention again, but then their friendship doesn't stay. They kind of, they don't become friends anymore for whatever reason. Here, they all stay friends. They're all. It hasn't even ruined their lives, if anything. I mean, they end up becoming even, financially well off because of it as well. Not because of the murder, but, you know what I mean? It didn't seem to have any effect on them until they got old and they started dreaming about it, sort of thing. And, yeah, I mean, that's what made the movie. I mean, the thing is, I like the movie, and I think I like the movie only because you see all these very old actors, and this is their last film role. You know, we got John, you know, we're going to be seeing, and when our two for one, because we're doing The Changeling and The Fog, John Houseman does The Fog the same year, and Mervyn Douglas does The Change same year as Ghost Story, and these are their last films that they do before they die, so it's quite an interesting one for as far as carrying the actors over. And I thought, and I can understand why they kind of went in this direction, because let's face it, the book is called Ghost Story, and, you know, and in the movie, I think the reason why the book's called Ghost Story is because it's about these group of guys who get together and they say ghosts, they give each other ghost stories, but the story is actually about something else, sort of thing. The movie, I think, what thought that, okay, that we need to call it Ghost Story because it's based on Ghost Story, but we need to make sure it is a ghost story. So that way, if they did the whole book premise sort of thing, I think maybe they thought the audiences would be a bit confused because it's not a ghost story sort of thing, maybe. But I think the script is good and I think everything's good. But my problem with the movie is that it lacks atmosphere.
Yeah.
You know, there's not a lot of atmosphere, and everything's kind of like, it's either really, really dark when they're in a dark room, or it's very, very bright. But it kind of lacks an atmosphere. You kind of want like a foreboding atmosphere. That so basically, like you're watching it, and there's something just creepy. There's something a bit creepy around the edges about it.
Like a Christmas Carol.
Excuse me?
Like a Christmas Carol, when you sense the spirits coming, and you know.
Yeah. It does. It lacks that. It kind of feels like, you know, I mean, you know, I understand like in the past, you know, when they have like, you know, they kind of do that Vaseline around the lens sort of thing. And, you know, when they go back to when they're younger, I can understand that sort of thing. But you kind of want, you know, like when they're at Anna Mobley's house, you just kind of want this. There's no sense of foreboding. There's not the sense of, you know, something horrible going on, something creeping in or something like that. Kind of felt a little bit like a TV movie, you know, those old horror TV movies. But, you know, I think that, I mean, if you look at this done in the past, you know, Tinker, Tinker, Tailor Spy, The Craze, he directed Let Him Have It, and Widow's Peak. He's a really known English director sort of thing. And I think that they probably would have been better with maybe someone who had a little bit more sense in directing horror or something like that. So, but, and, you know, and I was thinking about if they made this film today, would they be able to do it? Even if they did it as, I mean, I think you would have to make it like a Netflix series, but you don't really have the caliber of old actors that you could use nowadays. I mean, I guess you could throw Alan Arkin and Michael Douglas in there somewhere. And I guess Bruce Willis is about the age now, isn't he? So, because they're all about in their 70s. Bruce Willis is 69 now, sort of thing. You know. And yeah, so.
Well, but do you reckon if they would do that, like the remake, it would work?
You know, I think that if you've said it, I think if you said it in the time that it's set, and I think that it'd be nice to do a representation of the book, because I think the book is so detailed. And I think that you could, do it. I mean, even if you divide it up in, let's say, 3 or 4 parts, because the way the book is constructed, and let's say that you did even an hour or 2 hours for every part, the way the book is constructed, that you would still have, it's still eerie. I mean, there's enough there to keep it there. I mean, do start off with her, you know, in there, and then going back, and then you get the story of him, then you get the story of the Ghost Brothers. I mean, that's another thing in Ghost Story. They try to bring in those Ghost Brothers, but they're not ghosts, they're real people.
Yes.
But they kind of need to bring them in, and then they disappear. I don't know where they go. You know, Fenton and his brother. It's like, you know, we see one of them.
It was really interesting because it was like she went for one of them, right? And then it's like there were twins. Well, that's what I understood, right? And then she went for the other one. Like, kind of like, okay, well, she got confused. I don't know, because at the end, the one who has hurt her is like, is the one that is alive, and the other one that didn't even know her is like.
Yeah, and then you have the guy who's working with her with his weird little brother, and apparently he's like, they were part of a cult. And then he's like, you know, they're going around going, oh, she's going to get you. And then something like, and then it's like, then he's, you know, basically, I think he killed in the, you know, when John Houseman's character gets killed in the car accident or whatever like that. And he's in the car with him. And it's like, well, I don't, and then the little brother like bounces out of the car. But you don't really know how they became involved, because they're not ghosts or anything like that. Like, they're in the book, they're like real people. And you're like, okay, how did she grab these two people in, and what did she promise them? But it's kind of like a leftover from the book, but the book explains it. They don't really explain it in the movie. You don't know how. You know, they're kind of like taking bits and pieces, and they didn't put it together properly to finish off their story. So I think that didn't make a lot of sense. But
to me, what was a bit interesting is like in the movie, they even mentioned when they commit the crime, right? And she, well, as far as I understood, she was a real person. No one, did they even mention it? No one got interest in knowing what happened to her. Kind of like, okay, they kill her, she disappeared, and story. No one asked. The house remained closed.
Yeah, and it's just like, didn't she have any family or anything that came around looking for her? Or, yeah, it was weird. Because they say, they go, oh, what happened when she let, oh, you know, they just thought that she moved on. Okay, well, what, no one?
Yeah.
She had nobody? No family? Nothing? She just disappeared and no one cared? And then when they do find her, you know, this is another thing that's kind of weird about the movie. It's like, you know, if something happens and you find out, you know, they find the body, you know, years and years later, decades and decades later. I mean, does Fred Astaire's character, Ricky, just go on with his life, or does he get charged for her murder? Or does he, you know, it's like, oh, well, you're an old man now, or let's pretend this didn't happen, or, because you don't really know, because this ends with her, I guess, lying at rest. Now that her body's been found, I guess she lies to rest, so I guess that she doesn't need to haunt anyone anymore. But does Ricky have to pay for the crimes of his sins? Because you don't know. So yes,
it reminds It reminds me of, there's a Tales from the Crypt, I think it's season 4, episode 1, called None But the Lonely Heart, and it's where this con artist, he meets wealthy old widows and for a dating service, and he murders them to get the inheritance, but then they keep coming back to haunt him. And it just reminded me of that with the effects when she comes back as this corpse thing, like skeletal.
I mean, I guess another thing I don't quite understand is that, I guess it's the ghost story about it as well, because, you know, they're in New England. They changed the setting of the story because it's no longer New York State. It's New England, which means New England states are Connecticut, Vermont, New Hampshire. You know, that's New England. So they kind of changed that. But then she appears in California and would ghosts do that? I mean, because maybe, but I know that like let's say ghost stories that we know. Normally, ghost stories are kind of stuck in an area. They don't tend to travel across state.
You might have a freedom pass.
Yeah, you know, like the Amityville Horror. You know, the thing is, you know, whether you believe it's true or not, I mean, those ghosts don't leave the house. They pretty much stay in the house. They don't tend to travel around, or poltergeists. You know, they didn't. Well, I guess, I mean, poltergeists, the second one that ghost travels, and Carol Ann in the second one, the thing the house, I suppose, that one traveled. But, and why did she wait so long to get vengeance? And that's another thing I found a bit confusing about the movie. Why would you wait 60 years to get vengeance?
Yeah, I found that really interesting, because it's like, there's not even saying, okay, I don't know, if they would have said, okay, this thing happens every year. Every year someone has a vision of something strange happened, but it's just, okay, in that time, just because it happened, boom, she appeared back again. I want to take revenge. Yeah, that was really...
An interesting thing is that the wife of Fred Astaire in this movie is Patricia Neal. Patricia Neal is a world-famous actress, but what you might find even more interesting is that she is the wife, or was the wife, of Roald Dahl. So Roald Dahl of, you know, Matilda and BFG and Tales of the Unexpected, so on and so forth. So yeah. I liked the film, and I imagine that if you read the book and went to see the film, I think you'd be highly disappointed in the two of them. I knew that they were totally different, so that's the reason why I did two synopses this time. One synopsis for the book and a synopsis for the film, because they are kind of two different things. Which, as a movie itself, I think it's a fine movie. It's an interesting movie. I enjoyed it. As a representation of the book, it's very disappointing, sort of thing. You know, but it's an odd thing. I mean, it's,
Well, I think it's a thing that we will find, like, everyone who decides to, I don't know, read the book and then watch the movie, you will always find, okay, the director, I don't know what we're thinking, this is like really strange, not connected, or he's really accurate. And I think that sometimes I think happens when they're going to make the adaptation, right? They get the rights. I think that's the condition that maybe the author put. Because, for example, when Harry Potter was going to be made, the first movie, she sold the rights. She sold the rights with one condition, that she could be in the set all the time, checking if they were doing what they were saying they were going to do, and they respect the story. And that's why when you watch the movies, you said, okay, yes, it's with a different, with some tweaks, because they have to do it, because it's impossible sometimes. But it's really, really like accurate to the story. The same I found in like The Lord of the Rings and other movies. So,
well, to be honest, I think to do ghost, I mean, I don't think you could do ghost story, the book, in a 2-hour movie, really.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, are the two stories linked? The only thing that links them are the character names, but everything else beyond that is nothing. I mean, there's nothing comparing these two movies, I mean, the book and the movie whatsoever. The movie is a totally different story from the book. It's just a name only, and the character names. That's the only thing that, which is, you know, which makes it quite interesting, that basically you can take the book, you can buy the rights to a book and basically take the book and take the characters and then run, kind of do your own story sort of thing. And that's pretty much what they've done. Cause they, you know, there's nothing, you know, and I have, you know, and I guess that's probably the best way to do a really thick book into an hour and a half to a 2-hour movie sort of thing. Because I don't, you know, I do think that if you did bring in the, you know, the plot from the book into the movie, I mean, You know, that means bringing in the Manito, bringing in the shape-shifting, right? You know, explaining all that situation out and sort of thing, you know, and then also, you know, you got a bunch of, you know, classic Hollywood actors that you've thrown into this movie. And I mean, let's face it, these actors are basically the cream of the crop. I mean, we're talking about, this is old Hollywood, and this is their last film. I mean, Fred Astaire, Douglas Fairbanks Jr. and, you know, Mervyn Douglas and John Houseman. I mean, we're talking about, you know, royalty, Hollywood royalty. And I imagine that they probably didn't come cheap, sort of thing.
Well, probably they would have hired four different actors, not really, really famous. They would have been able to do the proper story and with three parts.
Yeah. And, you know, I do think that, I think this, you know, another thing that's quite interesting is that at this time in 1981, television was really big on the miniseries. The miniseries were coming where they're taking really thick books and able to adapt them into like five or six night, you know, television events. And I think that Ghost Story probably could have done that quite easily. You know, they probably could have turned it into that. And then you could could have got your whole shapeshifter storyline there. The Alma character appearing in all these different ages and different time periods and so on and so forth. And, you know, the ghost stories are happening, like, you know, the Fenton storyline and the brother and so on and so forth. And yeah, I think that that's the only way that you probably could do this justice. Though saying that, a movie quite liked the story that the movie tells. I found the direction a bit weak. I kind of wish it kind of had just a bit more atmosphere to it. Mm. You know, when we do The Changeling in 2 weeks' time, I mean, that's a film with a lot of atmosphere and stuff like this, or The Fog. The Haunting is another one, you know, the classic 1960s film. It's got a lot of atmosphere. So I kind of wish it had a bit more atmosphere. Though I have to sit there and say that Alice Krieg was fantastic. You know, the woman who gets her, comes back, she was brilliant. You know, Craig Wesson, the young guy in it, I mean, you know, he did Body Double, and, you know, he's also known for Nightmare on Elm Street 3 sort of thing. Yeah, I think they could have done with a better character than him, because whenever he felt scared or frightened, he kind of looked a bit hammy. Okay. So, is there anything else you want to add about the movie Ghost Story?
I agree what Leandro said, but I think it could do with a remake or some like vrooshing up a bit, like even a Netflix series or something . I think that would do it justice. Because I think it deserves it. It's a good story.
Yeah, I agree. We got a great multifaceted book storyline that kind of was pared down to like a murder mystery story, which is not the thing. That's not what the book is. Sort of thing, so,
I don't know this. I'm going to ask. Maybe you know. In that time when this movie was made, they used to be really long movies, like 3 hours, or the majority of them used to last an hour and a half, 2 hours as maximum.
I think that around this time, the film industry was kind of, I mean, you had your Godfathers and things like this.
Yes.
But I think, you know, about, you know, an hour, 45 minutes to 2 hours. They didn't really go out past the 2 hour mark. And we're getting at the start of the multiplexes as well, where it's about turning, where long films were not seen as viable because you wanted as many showings as possible. And the shorter the film, the more showings you could show, which means the more people were going through the doors to see it. And that's the reason why, like, a lot of films in the 80s, 80s to the 90s are not that long. They all tend to be about an hour and a half. And it's very rare to get that to mark at all, and during that time period in films. And it had to do with the multiplexes, again, as many people through the door as possible.
Yeah, because also I know that before they used to make, when they used to make the movie, they were like recording in a tape, and that used to be really, really expensive. So sometimes, you know, it's like, you know, sometimes imagine that the actor made a mistake. These days, it's digital. They do it again, there's no problem. But that time, it's like they couldn't record it on the top of the tape. You have to throw it away or cut it. Or so I was thinking, well, if you have Fred Astaire and all the other, well, they're really good actors, plus visual effects, all that, well, probably they won't be able to make the story as it was. They have to start to change to make it. And then, well,
a lot of these actors that were filming this were actually would end up dying within the year after the film was done. So we're dealing with really old actors as well. So there might have been restraints on that as well that we don't know about. Marvin Douglas died, 4 months before the movie was even released. So he died. John Houseman and Fred Astaire died within a year. And same thing with Douglas Fairbanks Jr. He died within a year as well. So all these old actors, you know, by the time the film was finished out, they would be dead within the year. So there could have been some restrictions on that as well. And the filming restrictions is like, we can't, you know, and the thing is, you know, the snow that you're seeing, all that snow and everything that you're seeing in this movie, that snow is real. It's not fake snow that they used, that they did this thing. They filmed it up that way sort of thing. So that's going to create a lot of problems as well sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, the cold.
Cold people, sort of yeah.
You know, where I think if the story was kind of reversed a little bit, let's sit there and say that, you know, he couldn't do it, but you know, let's say they had the younger selves done in the snow and then the older people done in, you know, like in the summertime that, you know, in reverse. Yeah, maybe it would have been different. You know, a bunch of elderly men kind of wandering around in the snow and the cold. And I can tell you in upstate New York, I mean, we're talking, you know, if I do it in Celsius, we're talking about like 10 to 20 degrees minus Celsius.
Oh, wow.
So that's what we get up there.
That actress was really famous or not?
This is her first movie. She's done other films since this time. She did Sleepwalkers, which is based on Stephen King. She's done other stuff outside after this movie. But I think this was the trailer says introducing Creed, so I think it might be her first movie.
And in all the movies, she's like a bit like crazy or not?
She does play crazy quite well. She also was in a couple Star Trek movies as well. I think she was one of the Borgs or something like that. I'm not a Star Trek fan yet. I'm sure that if you are a Star Trek fan, that you probably know more about her as far as that goes. But yeah, she's done quite a lot of things like this. Chariots of Fire she was in. That was her first feature film. And then Ghost Story was after that. So, you know, and she got a lot of good notices for Chariots of Fire because that was an Academy Award winning film and stuff like this. But she's from South Africa. That's where she's from. And she's a stage actress, but she's won Olivier Awards for on stage and stuff like that. And, you know, she's kind of the person who does like King Lear and The Tempest and Taming of the Shrews. She's like classically trained actress. As far as her film career goes, her film career tends to be a bit on the dark side, but that might have something to do with, I think when she did Ghost Story, I think that kind of like, okay, you're going to be doing, you know, that might have typecast her somewhat. You know, but she's done like Barfly, Haunted Summer, Sleepwalkers, but yeah, Star Trek. But yeah, looking at her CV here, she seems to do a lot of the darker sci-fi / horror films, or she tends to be, I mean, she's in a new Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie that's coming out, and she plays the mother to Leatherface. So far as the theatrically, yeah, I think she's classically trained. I think film-wise, I think she's probably been typecast a little bit.
The author has got a lot of awards as well.
Peter Straub.
Yeah, he's got 8 Bram Stoker Awards, 3 International Horror Guild Awards, 10 Fantasy World Fantasy Awards, and then he was made, in 1997, he was made the Grand Master at the World Horror Convention. And he got a Lifetime Horror Writers Association Achievement Award in 2005. No, 2010, he got a WFC Life Achievement Award.
And you can I'm probably going to read a bit more Peter Straub books, actually. I want to read more. So. So, on a scale of 5, what would you score this, starting with you, Craig, the film?
Oh, out of 5, I'll give it a 3 out of 5, I think, because it's dated and I think it's really overdue a remake.
Mm. What about yourself, Leandro?
Even though it has played a spare 4, I wouldn't say it's 5 out of 5. But 4 is okay.
I'm going to give it 3.5 at a push sort of thing. You know, I love that it has the old actors in it. I think the director went a bit off. He needed to have a bit more atmosphere. If it had a creepy atmosphere, I would have given it a 5-star.
Yeah.
You know, it has, you know, because I said before, the script, it's got a good script, and I like the ghost story side of it, though it has nothing to do with the book. But if it was just a bit more creepier and would haunt me a bit more, I probably would enjoy it. And nothing to do with the special effects. You don't need special effects to make it creepy sort of thing. So
yeah. Well, you know, I have been finding that I used to watch not a lot of terror movies when I was a kid, but then I started to watch more. And then the last movie that I found out it was like feeling like anxious and all that type of feelings. It was like Saw.
Yeah.
And if you see the movie, it's not a terror movie, but it's create that tension. And then after that, I that was the last one I have seen. I have seen, for example, Scream and had those tension moments, but there's nothing like, it's like terror, like, I don't know, like, maybe it's because I grow up, but...
I think the hardest thing to do in a film is create atmosphere and keep an atmosphere going. Yes. There have been some modern stuff that I have that seen that does keep an atmosphere going that haunts you long after you watch it. Wolf Creek was like that for me. I saw Wolf Creek, and that movie stayed with me for a good couple weeks afterwards. It's like still like haunting me afterwards. I'm not talking about like nightmares stuff like this, but it kind of just set me on edge. A film called Switchblade Romance, Ho Tien Xiong, did that for me. A lot of French horror films do that for me as well. American films, you know, whether it's for the Conjuring films or any of those kind of films, I mean, they're fine. I'll watch them, but they don't really create them. They don't, you know, you kind of have like your shop things. Like there's always going to be, you know, they're going to be the, you know, the window thing, the mirror. It's like the mirror, they look at themselves in the mirror, they go down and they look up and there's someone there, and, you know, the shop, you know, there's always a shop thing. But
when they open the bathroom cabinet with the mirror on it.
Yeah.
They close it.
I guess the others is quite good, but Nicole Kidman, that has an eerie creepiness to it. You know, Nicole Kidman and the others, I'll get, you know, that does. So everyone's The Innkeepers has a creepiness to it sort of thing that you kind of like.
The Candyman.
You feel on edge while watching it. So they did. There are some films out. I think it's a hard thing to do though.
Talking about ghosts, one movie I would like to recommend is, I watched the other day, the new Ghostbusters.
Oh.
Any good? I haven't seen it.
With Melissa McCarthy and other 4 girls. And I really, really, really like it because it's a new movie, more or less same subject, but up here, all the actors, all the 4 or 5 old ones, they appear, even the slime ghosts, all the ghosts appear at least 1 second, even what's the name, this name is really hard to pronounce, Weaver, the actress.
Sigourney Weaver.
Yes. She appeared at the last part of the movie for, I don't know, it's a minute, but I really, really like it, how they put it together, you know, because I think that, you know, sometimes when you watch a movie that they're trying to recreate it like in these days, you will still have like attached to the original one. So I really, 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 really enjoy the twist. I think that's a good way to catch the audience, you know.
Now, I'll give that a shot, actually. I'll tell you what's really good that I'm quite enjoying is the Chucky TV series is quite good.
Is that on Netflix?
I'm loving it. I'm watching it through a website that's sort of thing, but hopefully it'll open here, actually. It's really good. Andy Barclay's back. Jennifer Tilly's back. Every single person that lived in all the Child's Play films comes back.
I just saw the new Candyman, and they return to Cabrini Green in the new Candyman, which is really good. It's like a little nod to the first one.
I would like to watch that movie. Yeah, also the Freddy Krueger one, because when I was a kid, I used to be scared of Freddy, you know, and I watched like parts, but never completely the whole three. And when I remember when I was like 9 years old, I used to watch X-Files. It was really weird because it was like feel scared, but I used to like, because there were all some episodes that were explaining what happened, but the others that they could never resolve completely the case. And you know when it led you thinking, I remember that the intro of the program, there was a face doing like all like making the picture like larger. I used to feel really like scary about that. I don't know.
That's the Eugene Toombs, wasn't it? Where he could stretch his body into like small crevices to kill people. Eugene Toombs. So. Okay, so what we're going to do is I think we'll finish off our ghost story episode, and just to let you know that next week will be a Bewitched, and our 2-for-1 The 80s will become Change from 1981 and The Fog from 1981. And then, of course, we'll be continuing with Dark Shadows. And so it's good night for myself. Good night, Leandro.
Have a good night, and see you soon.
Good night, Craig.
Good night, everybody. Thank you.
And our next Kings of Horror will be Little Shop of Horrors, which is a remake from the 1960s classic by Roger Corman, but we'll be covering the musical, which came out in 1988. So we'll see you next time. And the kind of girl I am, he's my kind of guy.